From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. If you were in a hardcore punk band in the 1980s, Salt Lake City always proved to be one of the most intense, strange gigs on the circuit. Salt Lake fans could be ecstatic about the music to the point of physical violence, and the underground music culture that grew out of this era proved to be remarkably vibrant. As hardcore punk began to flame out, Utah developed its own organic scene with devoted fans and talented bands who were testing and experimenting with the form. But like hardcore, Utah's punk scene burned itself out before the turn of the century. Today in the program, as we begin a series exploring the past and present of Utah's local music scene, we're talking about Utah's underground music culture in the early 90s. What was it about the music, about the place, that made this moment so unique and special for those who experienced it? We hope you'll join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The graphic artist and punk rocker Winston Smith said that every generation has something to react to. In the mid-1980s, the hardcore punk movement came out of the social conformity of the Reagan 80s and the mind-numbing boredom of the American suburbs. So in that sense, it makes sense that Salt Lake City became an important venue with engaged, excited, sometimes violent fans. But as hardcore punk burned itself out, Utah's underground music scene was able to thrive for a time. Well into the 1990s, hundreds were packing places like the Painted Word, the old Indian Center, the Speedway Cafe. Today in the program, we're beginning a series of programs talking about the local music scene, and today we're exploring the music scene that came out of that punk movement. Hard to pin down a name for the sound. Some of these musicians came out of straight-edge bands. The seminal Utah band Like Iceburn fused coarse riffs with atonal jazz and hard rock, and in the process, they all developed a pretty tight community with a remarkable sense of vitality. We invite you to join us. 585-WEST is the number, 585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Joining us here in the studio is Brad Collins. He was the owner of Ranch Records. The store specialized in underground hardcore music. It was the central meeting ground for early Salt Lake punk scene and the underground music scene in general here in Salt Lake. Collins also hosted a weekly radio show you may remember on KRCL, of course called Behind the Zion Curtain. Brad Collins, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Doug. Nice to be here.
Gentry Densley is also with us, the former guitarist and leader of the band Iceburn I mentioned. He's currently guitarist for the bands Smashy Smashy and Form of Rocket, both of which can be heard in venues throughout Salt Lake City. Gentry Densley, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Stormy Shepherd is with us also, the founder of the national booking agency Leave Home Booking. She's the agent for the bands The Offspring, Rancid, and AFI. In 1995, Leave Home Booking was the first agency run by a woman to win the Agency of the Year award from Polestar. Stormy Shepherd, welcome to you.
Thanks.
Brad, I want to start with you.
Okay.
When did you first become exposed to this kind of music?
There's a couple of things that happened for me. First of all, in 1978, there was something on CBS News, and my mom said, come in and look at this. This is the new stuff. And my mom's pretty hip. I mean, she is really a hip lady. So anyway, she came in and she said, hey, look at this. And I said, oh, this is gross. I don't like it. And after that, I didn't pay any attention to it, and I was a record collector.
Yeah.
And I kept buying records and records, and records kept getting lamer and lamer. And eventually I started buying a few punk things through the Cosmic Airplane. That was my first real introduction to the music. They were a great store at the time. Nothing really came close to it before or since, really, as far as I'm concerned. And that's where I ended up finding out. And this is 1979.
Right.
So after that, it's a long time till 1984 when Ranch Records opened. But 79 is when both Susan and I started doing the radio show at KRCL. We were buying a lot of records. We were funding the show through the records. And that's why the grassroots thing made so much appeal to so many people, I think. It's because the do-it-yourself attitude in the music and the fact that you had to hunt for it. There was a certain reward there for some reason.
It was like a treasure hunt in some way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, it was really fun that way. You'd buy a band that you didn't know anything about, and the music was so diverse back then that there was no genre, really. It was punk and new wave. That's what we called it. We didn't know anything else. After that, it splintered into a million different categories, and you know, it just exploded, really. In our minds, it exploded. Yeah. I don't know if it really did.
Yeah.
You know, I talked to a lot of people, old guys that have been in bands for years and years who, you know, they're working jobs like I'm working now, which is very menial, and, you know, they're not getting any reward out of it, but they were there, and it was important then.
Stormy, what about you? What was what did you find that was so appealing about this kind of music? Do you remember when you first discovered it?
Yeah, I remember. I mean, one of the first things I ever did when I was probably 15 was one of my older friends in the neighborhood took me to Ronch Records. And that's where, you know, Brad actually, and I'm sure he doesn't remember this, but he actually turned me on to a lot of the bands that I ended up becoming interested in when I was younger. But it was more of the community and the fact that it was so different from what other kids at school were into. And I liked that.
Yeah.
So.
What about you, Gentry? You mean were you drawn as a musician, or was your experience similar to that?
I didn't even play guitar back then, and I was just a crazy little skater kid. And actually, I moved up to Salt Lake from Las Vegas, kind of moved around a lot. My dad was a golf pro, so we lived in Vegas. You got year-round golfing there. So, and came up. Actually, I went to like ninth grade, I think it was, with Stormy at this middle school out in Sandy, and me and my friends would take the bus and go under the viaduct to the dangerous part of town and go to Ronch Records. And yeah, I remember buying the Puss Head signed Zorlak skateboard deck from you there. So I was into skating, and then I got all into music, like going to Alice's and like just sitting up there and watching some of the bands, and even the local bands like Victims Willing and The Stench. And I was just like, wow, I want to play. And so,
do you remember what it was though about it? Was it that it was kind of raw? That it was
very.
That's what was appealing about it.
Well, it was the whole. I don't know. It was like a thing. Well, it was kind of like he was saying, where it's you're discovering this stuff for yourself, and it's like almost like nobody else knows about it, and it's your own little thing. Although, you know, and there's a community there, so it's like discovering a community that's, and it was very supportive, I think. And even though, like, Brad would be mean to you sometimes in the shop or something. But.
Well, you're supposed to be.
You got to get a reputation.
I mean, it's a rough part of town down there, and it's not as bad as it was, you know. I mean, without the viaduct, there was no shelter anymore. So the guys were down there under the viaduct, and the kids would come down on their skateboards, or some of the girls would take the bus to State Street, and, you know, they were like 15 years old, and they'd be walking down to Fourth West to the store, and, you know, it was really fun. I mean, at the time, I don't really understand how fun it might have been, because I was running a business, kind of. I wasn't, you know, and in a way it wasn't a business, but in a way it totally was a business. And, you know, that was after 5 years of being on the radio. Okay, I had a big record collection, and the only way I could maintain the record collection, because Cosmic was getting really splintered. At that time, they were trying to do a lot of things. They were doing books, they were doing jewelry, the music, and the music was splintering because New Age was happening.
Sure.
The women's music was happening then. All this stuff that we understand as mainstream now was just exploding then. And so they didn't have enough resources to do the underground labels, where the DIY labels like Touch and Go, Discord, SST, all those labels started happening, and there was no venue here for it. So for us, it was a natural that we start the record store, even though we didn't really understand what we were doing from putting on one show at a campus show up here. There was two shows at the SAE House, which was on 13th East. One was Minor Threat, and that was a fiasco, but it was very cool. The second one was Legal Weapon and Articles of Faith from Chicago, and that was really great. And that's where we started. Daphne and I started the record store basically there.
Yeah, wow. So when these young kids would come to you, you know, when Gentry and Stormy would come to you, did you sort of feel like, and I guess all the people who came to the store, was it you were kind of providing some guidance to say, look, try this, see this? I mean, what was it like, that experience?
You know, that's the thing. I don't really feel like I was a mentor in any sense of the word. And guidance, I don't really think I offered. I think I offered guidance as far as selecting a record that maybe somebody liked. I have some insight that way. I can figure out what people are looking for maybe. But in terms of the guidance thing, well, that's something you get at school.
Yeah.
We weren't a school at all.
Yeah, right. No. 585 West, by the way, the number to join us, 585-9378. Joe is calling from Provo.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Joe, sure.
I just wanted to say I really appreciate all your guests, Gentry and all, for the music they made. I grew up in California as a Mormon kid, and we listened to Iceburn, Engine Kid, Ashes, Still Life, Minor Threat, Gorilla Biscuits, bunch of those bands. And as a straight-edge kid, you know, we really appreciated the music you guys were putting out. And I came up to BYU here to go to school and was hoping to catch an Iceburn show and never did. But and I wanted to find out if, you know, they do any shows or anything, any of their new bands do any shows.
Oh, yeah, I play all the time. Former Rocket plays quite a bit. We just played down in Provo last month sometime at Starry Night. But we're playing tomorrow up in Ogden, and we got a few shows around. And then we're heading out to Colorado and Wyoming and stuff and doing a little jaunt in July. But, yeah, we kind of book everything ourselves and do it all pretty lo-fi DIY style.
Wait, so in that sense, it really hasn't changed from the
90s? No, not really. I mean, it's had its ups and downs, and there's been, like, great opportunities, and they slip away or whatever, but I think it's all, you know, for the best in as far as my state of mind and life goes, so I'm happy now.
Yeah. 585 West, the number to join us, 585-9378. I was referring to that, to Winston Smith quote where he said every generation has something to react to. And I was thinking of Joe, you know, good Mormon kid from California, comes to BYU, he's ending up at these venues. And Stormy, I'm thinking about you, sort of came from that culture as well. What was the connection there between sort of Mormon upbringing and these really harsh, intense hard rock songs that were, or hard punk rock songs that were working for you, do you think? Was there a connection?
No, I don't think there was any connection, but I do think that you have, just because you're in Utah and the, you know, predominant population is Mormon kids, you're just as interested in that same kind of music as anybody else is. And so
I mean,
I'm practicing Mormon.
Sure.
I'm 100%, so.
But so the idea that, you know, again, that there were a lot of these young kids who were sort of dealing with the boredom of the suburbs and dealing with the conformity of the 80s and the kind of feathered hair, bands from in pop culture. You don't think that Mormon kids, Brad, were reacting
well,
to something in particular?
Well, you got to remember that the straight edge and the punk scenes are two entirely different things.
Yeah.
Okay, the straight edge thing is a very easy thing for the Mormon kids to grasp. And so for us here, straight edge was a huge deal because it was already in the society. It had nothing to do with the music at all. People would come out to the edge shows because there was like-minded kids that weren't drinking, weren't smoking, weren't having sex, weren't doing anything. And then there was the other side, which, you know, is a little more fond of my heart, which is the debauchery, you know, the nihilism, everything that we love about all the old punk bands, the Sex Pistols and bands like that. So there's all these, there's two sides of the coin there. Unfortunately, I think both sides kind of got a little shafted in the end, really. I mean, it just turned into a thing where everything exploded so big, and so there's some bands that are in this great place right now, and then the other bands, like Gentry's saying, are still doing the, you know, house parties. I mean, seriously, they're doing house parties. And in the 80s, it was just so great because we'd get these kids, they'd be on the road, they'd be in a bus, they had to stop here, Doug. There's nowhere else to go. They have to stop in Utah.
Right.
And
right.
Some of the bands tried to do a new routing. And the what I noticed was that they would go to Phoenix, they'd go to California, they'd go to Montana before they'd come here.
Wow.
And then they'd drop down to Denver. Well, a lot of bands, they have to come through Salt Lake. It's, you know, it's a no-brainer. It's 700 miles, and it's 700 miles, so they got to stop. And so we were lucky that way. Really lucky.
Mm.
I'm not saying anything bad about the straight edgers, am I?
No, not at all.
Well, when that whole thing started, it was such a different thing. I mean, you remember the Unity House and stuff. It was just like everybody was so positive and like it was all about, like, getting together and having fun and goofing and, like, just not having the pressure of, you know, I got to
find
some
drums
or something.
It was all for one and
one for all. Yeah, it was really like a unity thing. And then I don't know what happened after that with all these. It just went crazy and people, like.
The way it became so violent. And
yeah, it got really ugly.
They're trying to emulate the New York scene.
And, you know, after, what was that, 95 was when my store closed pretty much. I mean, it was pretty much over with. But the kids were really starting to become a problem. The edge kids were going around and really being, and this is like 15 years after, like, bands like SSD Control and Minor Threat were having their little, you know, Boston, D.C., like, weirdnesses, you know. And New York never really got involved with that. New York kind of was always isolated that way. They didn't really have a problem with Boston and D.C. because they always felt superior, of course. New Yorkers always did. And so we've got a New Yorker here.
585 West, the number to join us, 585-9378. David's with us in Salt Lake. Hi, David.
Hey. Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
Hey, I just want to say how good it is to hear Brad Collins' voice on the radio again. I grew up listening to Brad on KRCL and buying records from Ronch, and I heard him say that he's not a mentor, but I think that he's responsible for the punk rock roots that Salt Lake had, and I just want to thank him for bringing it to me.
Appreciate that, Dave.
Yeah.
You're responsible for
responsibility.
Working.
Responsibility, yeah. That's kind of ugly, really. I mean,
well, we sort of had to drag Brad here in some ways. Do you feel kind of reluctant about going back to those times in some ways?
Well, you know, it's just odd to me now. I feel pretty detached from it all, and it's really, I don't know why I would feel that way. I just do. Yeah. I don't know, really. Yeah.
David, thanks. Glad you called. Let's see. Rob is with us in Salt Lake. Hi, Rob.
Hey, I just wanted to say about the same thing as David. As much as you're reluctant to admit it, Brad, you were a mentor to all of us. You were the kind of the center of our universe back in 84, 85, 86. I lived at a house we called the Zoo and hung out with the band they called Local Death Squad, which I don't know if you can figure out the acronym for that.
Yeah.
And we were certainly trying to spin as far away from the conformity of Salt Lake as we possibly could. And Brad and the punk scene gave us an absolutely wonderful avenue to do that and express ourselves. And it was kind of a do-it-yourself thing, like you were saying, Brad. I don't think you ever told anybody how to do anything, but we certainly were listening to you, and you gave us a direction as far as what music was cool and you know, I just wanted to say thanks as well. It was a huge part of my life when I was younger. And I'm quite detached from it as well. I've gone through the Grateful Dead scene and done some other things with my life. But it's all super important to my history. And thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah, good. I appreciate that.
Cool. Rob, glad you called. Thanks a lot. Make you feel old, Brad, in some ways?
Some ways, but I was already old. You know, I was already like an aging guy that was a record collector that was looking for a lot of music. Yeah. And at that time, I was 25 years old already, which, you know, doesn't seem to be really that old now. But still, when you're talking about high school kids, 25 years old is 10 years old.
Yeah.
So gets weird.
It makes me feel young.
Does
it? Yeah, it should.
585 West, the number to join us. Let's see, John is with us in Tooele, Utah. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
Great. Just had a few comments. That music scene was a huge influence in my life. I started going to shows. I remember my first show was the Dead Kennedys at the Horticulture Building.
Yeah. That's great.
Out at the fairgrounds. They call it something else now, don't they?
And, you know, for me, I think that music was, I grew up here in Utah being a non-LDS person, and it was kind of a way out of Utah, if you will. It was so different from anything else that was going on. And also, I was a skater, and so that kind of segued into the music also, because Thrasher Magazine was our Bible, and a lot of this music was advertised. I remember a lot of SST stuff advertised in the Thrasher magazine, so it was just a natural. But the one comment I'd like to make is that the music, just for me, and I may sound old saying this, but it just hasn't been the same as far as being so raw and so new, and I haven't found anything else like that since then. So it was a big influence in my life.
Yeah. Well, we're going to talk about whether or not there's anything like it today. We're glad you called, John. Thanks very much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
585 West, again, the number 585-9378. Brad Collins is with us. He is was the owner of Raunch Records, a host of the weekly underground music program on KRCL for years called Behind the Zion Curtain. Stormy Shepherd is the head of the Salt Lake-based Leave Home Booking. Gentry Densley was the guitarist for Iceburn. He's currently playing for Smashy Smashy and Form of Rocket. We invite you to join us. 585 West is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We're going to take a brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on FM 90. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are beginning an occasional series exploring the past and present of Utah's local music scene. If you were into obscure but raw music, there was a brief moment in the early 90s when Utah's underground music scene really lived up to that name. They called it punk, but that wasn't the best way of defining the sound. Today in the program, we're talking about a tight community with a remarkable sense of vitality that grew out of that music scene, and we invite you to join the conversation. 585 West is the number, 585-9378, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Gentry Densley is with us, guitarist for the band Iceburn. Was the guitarist anyway, currently playing for Smashy Smashy in Form of Rocket. Stormy Shepherd is the head of the Salt Lake-based Leave Home Booking. She's with us here. Brad Collins, the former owner of Raunch Records and host of the really immensely popular music program on KRCL, Behind the Zion Curtain. Andy Patterson is joining us. He has been the drummer for the bands Lumberjack, State of the Nation, and Red Bennies, currently playing for the Hudson River School, producing albums locally. Andy Patterson, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, let me ask you, what is it that made a good band good? Could you explain, Stormy? What made a good band good?
What made a good band good? Well, because I'm not a musician, I would say, I mean, just from the side of, you know, when I was living out here in the late 80s, early 90s, I was putting on a lot of shows. And one of the things that stuck out to me was if kids were coming to see them, and if they were actively trying to put out their own records, touring, anything they could do to get their music out there, that to me made a good band good. And
was their ability to promote?
Well, their ability to, if they had a good work ethic, huh, and they didn't expect somebody else to do it for them, and you know, and if they played music that kids liked, that's, you know, that to me was a good band. But, you know, that's coming from a non-musician point of view.
What about you, Gentry? How do you explain it?
I think it's more like a feeling, like actually either seeing them or listening to it and all of a sudden just having a chill kind of run down your spine. And you're like, whoa, this is some cool stuff.
Like all art, it's hard to explain.
Yeah,
I mean...
It's rather abstract, but it probably has a lot to do with the environment and your state of mind and what you're, you know, what appeals to you at the time. But for me, it was always like something new and fresh always kind of gave me that chill that was like somebody I hadn't really heard before. And I'm like, wow, that is cool. So
again, that process of discovery, I guess.
Andy,
what about you? What works? Could you put your finger on it?
I think it's just if the bands are really all about, or the members of the bands are really about what they're doing, I think it creates a special kind of a vibe. I think, you know, bands that just kind of go through the numbers or sort of phone it in, you know, like ends up not being as special or whatever. But you can tell when a band is really all about their music, you know, even if it's not something that appeals to the large, you know, mass populace or whatever. It, you know, you can tell by the way that they interact with each other or even the way that they promote their band. You know, back in the day, it was basically flyering was the only way that you could promote the show. And so you could tell if the band really wanted you to be at the show. You'd see it, you know, 9th and 9th and down, you know, positively 4th or at Raunch.
We all flyered together.
Yeah, you know, that was the only way to really get it out there. You know, once in a while, Brad or you know, would mention it on their air would be the only other form of promotion. So a band really had to want to have people at their at their show and work hard to get them there. So
I was pretty good at mentioning on the on the radio. I didn't really not talk about most of the good stuff.
I got to tell you, when I was driving up here, I heard your voice on the radio, and it kind of gave me a little
bit of
chills. Yeah, because he was a big deal for me, you know, listening to the radio show. So when I heard you on the air, it was just instant, like that smell or something.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Oh, it's Brad.
That's
on the radio.
That's great.
It's Fishhead.
Nice. 585 West, the number to join us. Matt is with us in Salt Lake. Welcome, Matt.
Yeah. I just wanted to thank Brad and Gentry for everything those guys did. I was kind of one of their little groupies of Better Way and Stench and Insight, and they just really shaped a lot of who I am today. I mean, I think back of the guys we used to skate and hang out with, and they're now lawyers and doctors and architects and graphic designers, and I don't think you guys understand the influence that mentality is going to be for generations in this city. And I just kind of wondered if you guys ever stop and think about what everybody that was just banging heads back then is now doing and how that influence is still around.
Well, you know, it makes me wonder about, you know, the thing that was so interesting about this kind of music was it had no kind of manufactured infrastructure. I mean, there weren't really, for a time, there weren't really labels. I mean, Stormy, you know about this as much as anyone, and you really, flyering, you had to really sort of, it was a grassroots kind of way of getting the word out. And I'm wondering if there was also a kind of, and Gentry, I won't make too much of this, but a kind of, there was a kind of purity about that it didn't get corrupted by sort of corporate culture or anything like that. Was that part of the appeal in some ways, Stormy?
Yeah, definitely, because nobody was doing it for money. Nobody was doing it to make a profit. Everybody was doing it just because you wanted to see good bands or you wanted your band to play. And that's why I was saying so many of us, you know, I mean, just sitting in this room, I mean, we flyered together, we put on shows together, and, you know, I mean, there's a lot of stuff that we all did. There was a big, you know, group of kids at that time, and everybody was working together kind of collectively, and it's not as utopian as it sounds, but people were working together, and it wasn't about money or profit or notoriety. It was because you wanted to see good bands and you wanted to hear good bands, and you know, the local bands, you know, the guys that lived here were playing those shows, and
we wanted,
you know,
to be good bands.
Yeah.
And you get kind of addicted to the getting up on stage and having like 300 kids, and you can just jump out on top of them with your guitar and they'll carry you around and stuff. And it's like, I mean, that whole, it's such a rush. And I just remember some of the early Iceburn shows being just so crazy like that. And
they weren't policed.
Yeah.
Well, you know, there's kind of an urban legend related to Iceburn, and I was hoping you could clear it up. As I understand it, you actually rejected signing with a label because you were worried about it somehow corrupting the band. Is part of that true?
Oh yeah, a couple times. And it was, I think, a lot of the mentality. Treble was like the drummer in the early band. His real name was Joseph Smith, so he went by Chuba. And
don't forget the Chad.
I hope he's listening now. He's an awesome guy. He just came out to one of my other shows with Eagle Twin. But I don't know, he was a philosophy major. I was switching into being a music major, and he had very strong ideas of where he wanted things to go, and he did not want to. We'd seen other bands and other friends like relinquish a lot of control of their music and what they wanted to do, and we were into doing these 20-minute epic songs at the time, so we didn't want to, you know, have anybody tell us what we could or couldn't do. So we kind of, I know, who was the guy from Atlantic that, Mike Gitter, yeah, he came up to us in New York and gave me his card and stuff and was schmoozing, but
yeah, but Mike was a good guy.
Yeah.
There's no reason to single him out because he came up through the whole scene like all
totally.
Us. And so, it, you know, the labels, they were there at the first. I mean, the Sex Pistols were on Sire, which was Warner Brothers, and there was all these bands that were on the big labels at the time. Nobody was an independent band till like 1981 or 82. I mean, it just didn't happen. And then SST started. Black Flag put out records. They were probably the first ones to put out their own records. besides some really weird guys out there that, you know, nobody really cared about, but there was guys that were putting out 7-inch vinyl, and the whole thing exploded in the underground to be a do-it-yourself thing. But before that, it was all controlled by the labels. I mean, there was nothing that was underground about early punk rock. So these guys were really lucky. They came into a time when everybody was making their own music. They were going on the road, like I said, you know, for their summer vacation. There was, and I have to say that everybody was out to make a little money. There was nobody that was on the road that was doing it. They were doing it for fun. But they had to make enough money to get from Denver to Salt Lake to San Francisco. There was no way to do it other than that, you know. And so, in a way, the middle period kids had a really good time because there was no rules. Everybody was making their own rules up, their records, their tours, their shirts, everything. So,
yeah, but Gentry, do you ever regret that, not signing? Do you...
No.
Really?
No, not at all. I mean, it was just, I don't know, we weren't really about that at all. And Iceburn kind of had this arc that I appreciate very much for what it is now. And I don't think it could have been any other way, really. So it came from this total place. And I've seen some, you know, things on the online talking about his stuff just from a pure hardcore band, and by the middle it was like half improvisation and half hardcore and all this other stuff, classical stuff, everything that we were learning kind of infused in there. And by the end it was a total improvisational outfit. And I was into records crazy back then too, and I started getting into all the free jazz stuff and all this stuff going back to the 60s before punk. And there was actually kind of a scene there where people were putting out their own kind of things, kind of aside from the labels like ESP and stuff, and they were putting out these crazy free jazz guys that were just, you know, playing this high energy stuff, and I totally was attracted to that. And so I think Iceburn ended up in this, you know, 100% improvised place.
Well, I want to actually play a clip from is it Hephaestus?
Hephaestus. That's how I say
it. It's as I understand. Okay, so it's like 79 minutes of one kind of continuous thought, broken into about four sections.
Four tunes, pretty much. But it's all weaved together. Yeah.
And in fact, Duncan, step up to a microphone here. We have Duncan Mensch here, who's a local journalist and an immense Iceburn fan himself.
True.
Duncan, put Iceburn in. They've been talking a little bit about it, but put it in context for the listeners in terms of kind of the importance for the local scene.
Well, I think there was this really interesting moment in time that was the Salt Lake scene. About, was it 93 when the album came out?
Yeah.
And I mean, Iceburn was just mixing all kinds of different genres. And I remember after Fyron, the first album came out, and all of my friends and I were just listening to that over and over again. We heard these rumors about Hephaestus, or however the hell you pronounce it.
Yeah.
Nobody could ever pronounce it.
We just
heard that it was extremely long and that you guys were going to be pushing all of the boundaries and that you were spending forever to produce it. I remember that it took like a year or something like this for you guys to produce it. It seemed like it never came out. And then I think I was at the release show as well, and you guys played it all the way through. And nobody really knew what to make of it at the time, but anybody who was paying attention knew that it was completely brilliant. And it's one of those albums that really stands the test of time, like most things. I mean, there's some things you put in the CD player and you listen to them again, and you're like, oh my God, I can't believe I was listening to this. But it isn't one of those things. And to mix the punk sounds, the metal sounds that I think you'll hear in this, and the classical, I mean, the way I see that album is like a gigantic symphony, a punk symphony. You're making a frowny face, but I mean...
How did you see it? Did you think of it in those terms?
I wasn't frowning. I don't know. It was just like everything in your brain trying so many new things and trying to put it all together. And we had basically three guys and very equal input across the board. So it all came together really nicely. And I don't know.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, we were listening to some of this morning. I was thinking of Miles Davis. There's kind of an improvisational quality to it.
Yeah, and the weird thing is, back then, we had to play. So it's separated. Each section that's like a 20-minute section or whatever, with the written and the improvised stuff, we had to play straight through with me and the bass player in one room, the drummer in another room, not being able to see each other, but just kind of feeling it. And I remember how. And there was no, I mean, later we did some overdubbing things and stuff, but all the raw tracks were just created like that. And then we made these little parts in between. And before, you didn't have the technology to do it all in one thing. We had to, like, run the DAT tapes and then switch over to the next tape, like, right at the right time and when we mastered everything. So it was really a weird process. And I guess it doesn't work on iPods.
Is that right?
It's divided up into like 23 tracks, but
let's hear a bit of it. Okay. This is from Iceberg. Iceburn. Can people still get that?
Oh, yeah. Finn? It's widely available. I have a bunch of blacked out promo copies that they couldn't sell, probably. So you can contact me. I have the white vinyl, too. That was nice. We used to make it's a double vinyl. So that was cool. All those old Iceburn records were colored vinyl and stuff because we were all crazy into records back then.
Yeah.
Total collector stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
585 West, by the way, the number to join us, 585-9378. Let's see, Teresa's been waiting in Salt Lake. Hi, Teresa.
Hey, how are you doing? Hey, everybody. How's it going? I started listening to the radio, and I was moved. Like, I got emotional because this was such a part of my life and influenced the kind of life that I have had, and I just wanted to thank everybody, and I also wanted to talk about how it influenced art. I have a friend named Rich Jacobs who did the covers of the Iceburn covers.
Yeah.
And he invited me to be in a show in LA called Move, and he has been curating this show now for about 10 years. And it was all the old schoolers like Daniel Higgs from Lungfish, guys from 3 Mile Pilot, and then big artists like Barry McGee and Joe Soren. And I just wanted to talk to you guys about how it's influenced art.
Well, Rich was, I mean, he was a part of like every record that we did. And he actually, he was from Colorado, and he would put on shows with, you know, and that's how we initially met him. With all sorts of different bands and Fugazi and whatever was going on back then. And so, but he lived around here for a bit. I think he went to UVCC or SC or whatever it was back then, before he went to LA to study art and stuff. But he's doing awesome. I mean, he did all the early covers. I don't know if everybody knows him, but he's had shows recently in Tokyo and Australia, and he did murals in Spain last year when I was talking to him, and I just saw him in San Francisco. He had a show there, so And he always used to say, you know, he would love to listen to the stuff and just draw stuff for us. And he's even put out records for us on his little Move label.
Wow.
So he's an awesome guy. Thanks, Teresa.
Teresa, glad you called. Thanks so much. 585 West, again, the number to join us. This is Dan Nalen, actually, of the Salt Lake Tribune, is writing in. He says, as we all know, the pop music writer at the Salt Lake Tribune, he said, I can honestly say I wouldn't be making a living writing about music if it wasn't for the scene that you all are talking about right now. I moved to Utah from the Midwest in the middle of high school, and if I wouldn't have found the Speedway Cafe, Painted Word, Raunch, Cinema in Your Face, and bands like Boxcar Kids, Dinosaur Bones, and AOL, I probably would never have fallen in love with Utah. Thanks for this blast from the past. I have to get back to writing a story about Poison now.
Sorry.
The band or the...
Tristan, who has her own show at Tristan Tabish, by the way, to KRCL, writes, in 1985, I found Brad Collins on KRCL. Having grown up in a small town, Brad provided me with the means to rebel and to shape my identity at a crucial age. From there, my life fell into place. I got a job at KRCL, eventually hosted a program, pursued a master's degree. The punk music scene helped give me confidence and self-esteem to be who I wanted to be. My girlfriends and I grew up at Raunch Records, the Speedway Cafe, and The Word. If my parents had known the details of our adventures, they would have grounded me for life.
Without a doubt.
585 West, again, the number to join us, 585-9378. Let's see. Kevin is with us in Salt Lake. Kevin, welcome to the program.
Hi. Hey, I wanted to thank all your guests for making a difference in a whole bunch of people's lives. First off, that's really important. You all were asking, you know, what made the music good, and it seems to me like one of the things that made the music good was the way it was presented. And it was a very, at times, very innovative. You know, there are bands like the Butthole Surfers and 9% of Neubauten and Crash Worship and the Flaming Lips back then even, and Psychic Television, and I knew some of those bands were coming through here. I wasn't in town much, but I'm wondering if your guests see that as an important aspect, and do they see bands picking that torch up today and continuing that tradition?
The level of creativity?
That level of creativity, yeah.
Brad, what do you think?
Well, I'd imagine so. I mean, really, I feel pretty detached from a lot of the music now, but... those bands that he's talking about were real innovators. I mean, most of those bands stood alone in their own little scene. I mean, Psychic TV, Crash Worship, they were all kind of, those people that followed those bands were all into that particular movement. And it wasn't really, like Psychic TV, they did all their records in one take and never, they were all live to tape. So they were really interesting that way. And Crash Worship, they were really into pyro. So they were doing all the pyrotechnics.
Right.
And, I mean, they did a couple shows down on Third West, and it was really cool. I mean, it was a different thing for sure. And even though it was maybe regurgitated over the time because other people had done weird stuff like that, I don't know. I don't know if it's still happening like that, really. I mean, it just doesn't seem like it's as free as it was in those days. I don't see venues actually accepting those kind of bands to create that kind of live thing. And if you can't, then you can't do it to record either, really, because you can't keep practicing. I mean, it just gets weird. Burning Man, that's where all those people are probably going now. Every year they go to Burning Man.
Exactly. But I think... Kilby Court actually provided a venue for a lot of really creative stuff. And initially, when I moved back here, that was the place to go. And I was doing some weird stuff, like sound experiments for 3 days in there, like setting up things and creating standing waves and stuff. And Phil, you know, let me do it. And, I mean, there was a few other things. That's where the Guitar Orchestra kind of started, which was... this massive guitar thing from kind of taken from Glenn Branca and stuff. But I don't know. I think Kilby Court was a great thing, and sometimes they still are able to get some bands in there, but I think the issue with making a living off it and being able to make money has kind of... Sometimes that kills the creative aspect of it.
What do you think?
Andy records a lot of bands.
Yeah, or Andy, what do you think about that?
I think there's, you know, Kilby Court's definitely a venue for stuff that's like a little left of center, but I think that the the majority of what people are into these days seems to be a little bit formulaic, you know? Mm. There seems to be like about three or four different kinds of bands now, and everyone kind of does that. And I think with MySpace and all these, you know, new developments with technology and people seeing what's going on out there, you'd think that it would be create a bigger, more different kind of a world with more diversity, but actually kind of homogenizes everyone because they see what's cool on MySpace or something, and they so there's like 15 bands that all have swoopy hair and girl pants and so I you know that takes over, and that's what draws the kids in, so that ends up being the, you know, the priority for a lot of venues, you know, so because they got to make money. And
Duncan Mensch, you were going to say.
Well, I think, and Kilby is really reflective of some of the really interesting aspects of Salt Lake, I think, because if you think about it, it's this shack. Literally. I mean, how many people can it fit in there? Maybe 50? Yeah, exactly. I mean, I remember once being in New York and I was talking to the lead singer of June of 44. I was saying, you know, I saw you guys in Salt Lake and I'd seen them at Kilby. And he's just kind of like thinking to himself, trying to place for a minute. And he goes, oh, you mean that place with one light bulb? He's like, yep. Oh, that's the weirdest place I've ever played a show in my whole life. Yep. And it's something that, I mean, when you saw a show in Salt Lake, especially in the 90s when the Club Stars closed down, you know, there was like a real gap. And underground really meant underground. I mean, do you guys remember the Moroccan?
Mm-hmm.
And cops were coming and shutting down shows a lot.
Definitely.
Moroccan was another little shack. It was like in an alley behind Guthrie Bicycle. I don't think they ever had a license.
Yeah, this was Dave's place, wasn't it?
And Riley from Ether. And Ether was, you know, there was some amazingly creative stuff that was going on there as well. Mm. And those guys coming, I mean, that kind of came from that whole Crash Worship thing, the Ether thing. And they took on some of the pyromania, too, I think, in there.
585 West, the number to join us. David is with us in Salt Lake City. Hi, David.
Hello. I had a question for Andy. Maybe you kind of already answered it, but did you guys mention that he recorded bands ever since then? And I've always felt the stuff that you did, Andy, is kind of like the sonic evolution of that music. I'm just guessing, but I guess the question is, do you kind of have your finger on the pulse of like where that all went?
That's right. Salt Lake scene is under my thumb. Well, I'm very fortunate that I know who I know, and I have the friends that I have, and that I'm able to actually have a running business of a studio and, you know, maintain to do that continually. But it's I think it's just part of just the fact that I've been playing for years, and I just, because I moved to California for a while, and when I came back, I decided to start a studio, and I basically just called all my friends and said, hey, let's make a record, you know, I have this equipment, you know, and I'll do it for free or whatever, and... Yeah. And I think it's just due to the fact that, you know, I'm totally just the luckiest guy ever because I've always been in the right place at the right time, always, you know.
That's for sure.
I mean, at one point, I've lived with Gentry before I knew him, really, and Stormy. I actually was friends with Stormy's little brother and before I met her, and I worked at Raunch, and, you know, before I worked at Raunch, I had a practice space above Raunch when it was on 4th and 4th, and so I had interaction with Brad telling us to shut up and not play before 7.
Was it a pretty incestuous kind of universe, this?
At the old days, at the 4th and 4th store, yeah, because everybody had, you know, their practice spaces there. A lot of people did anyway, and so we'd get a lot of people running through the store, and it was fun. It was really cool that way. Mm. Yeah, I think that's the way all little cliques are, and I just don't see it being any different, really.
Sean sends this email. Thought I'd drop a line to mention a few of the still active hardcore punk bands down in Provo. We've got Parallax, Rail Spike, Bullshit Authority, God's Revolver, all still regularly playing gigs, recording, touring, etc. I'd also like to mention that the bands that got me into punk were the Cronies, a now defunct Provo hardcore band. Great great band, he said. So what's the relationship between Provo and Salt Lake?
There's no relationship at all.
Yeah, sorry.
We don't really even talk about those guys.
I saw the Stents play there once.
In the straight edge scene, there's kind of an East Coast, West Coast war happening between the Provo straight edge kids and the Salt Lake straight edge
really?
Kids. Yeah, there's certain straight edge Salt Lake bands that won't play in Provo and vice versa.
I won't even drive down there.
In fact, at my studio, I record a lot of these straight edge bands.
Yeah.
And in my studio, sometimes I'll get these bands that, okay, we're coming in on Thursday, but don't tell anyone that we're coming in.
Well, they got jumped in the parking lot or
something? Yeah, because they don't want to have any beef go down at the studio.
Wow.
And, you know, of course, they're all really respectful at my place, and they never, you know, cause problems. But just the fact that they would have to, like, keep it secret, you know, because the Provo kids are coming or something. Wow. You know, it's like, it doesn't make any sense.
585 West, the number to join us. Dan is with us in Salt Lake. Dan, welcome.
Hi.
Hi.
Hey, Gentry and Andy, this is Dan. Just have a really nerdy question. I moved here in 2000 and started playing music and definitely missed the boat on this era. But just feel like you feel the influence. You feel you can, you know, in the people, in the bands, and not only when people talk about it, but I feel like there's actual, like, a sound to Utah, and maybe because it's so insulated, but even with, you know, recent bands that are around today, I can still hear that kind of style, and I was just wondering if you could comment on how pervasive that is in your eyes.
Hmm. Is there a Salt Lake sound? What do y'all think?
I think that's interesting because my wife always says that when we're listening to certain bands from Salt Lake, she's like, "Oh, that's such a Salt Lake band," and I don't really hear it. You know, maybe it's just like a chugga chugga part or something, but like, I don't really hear a huge Salt Lake sound per se. You know, but
usually
I mean,
that's an insult, isn't it?
Well, I think there was a whole thing that kind of evolved from like that Iceburn like took from the Bad Yodelers and from that kind of stuff because the Bad Yodelers were like so influential for me. It was like, I mean, that was a band that was like using the classical stuff and the metal stuff, and that was way before any of these Metallica thingies or any bands like that, and they were doing this amazing stuff. And I think that sound kind of did like germinate and make this kind of thing that still lingers a little bit.
What do you think, Stormy? What do you think? You hear a Salt Lake sound?
I'd rather not comment on it.
Okay, I won't push it. Here's an email from Tim who writes, "I have so many great memories from attending shows that Brad put on. I'd love to hear which concerts he remembers most. Anything stick in your minds?"
De Kreutzen at the underneath the record store when the Indian Center closed without telling me for a couple shows. One of them's been documented in a movie called American Hardcore, where Gangrene talks about the Salt Lake show and coming to my house and stealing stuff. Well, I don't know if they stole stuff or if I gave them something, but whatever the reason was, the Indian Center closed to resurface the floor, and they didn't tell us, and we had three shows set up. The guys in De Kreutzen from Wisconsin were really cool, and we did the show in the basement where, excuse me, it was really ugly down there, but it was very cool, and that's probably one of the best memories I have of any of the shows we did, just because they were so gracious and went ahead and played.
Wow.
My favorite band, I think, in the world.
Really?
Yeah. I still listen to that, because I first heard them on Brad's show, and I was just like, oh, I used to just flip out in my room, you know, and just, like, jump on the bed and listen to the Decoys.
That's great.
But, yeah.
Let me ask you this finally, all of you. Is punk rock dead?
No, it's not really. I mean, the attitude is generally going to always be there, whether it's a punk band or a speed metal band or whatever, or a noise band or anybody that takes control. I think that's the whole thing, is a do-it-yourself, take-control sort of attitude where you don't answer to anybody. Those kind of things will never go away as long as we have a free democracy. Doug, do we have a free democracy?
Well, I think Mike Watt said something really cool, which was, you know, punk is whatever we made it to be. And that just kind of says it all right there. Mm.
Yeah.
So.
And I didn't know what to call Iceburn, but I remember some writer said something that Iceburn was the most punk band that played music not resembling punk at all, you know. So
yeah. Andy, what do you think?
I think punk is sounds super cliche, but it's a state of mind, you know. It's an attitude. It's not necessarily a style or a genre, because there's punk bands out there that obviously don't sound anything like Dead Kennedys or, you know, anything like that. And I think it's just, you know, doing things for yourself and not trying to conform to what's happening mainstream, and just, you know, kind of forging your own path is a punk ethic, you know. So I think punk ethic will be around forever, you know, like any other sort of subversive culture, you know. But punk as we know it, as far as, like, you know, safety pins in the nose and the spike mohawks and all that, that's all fashion, you know.
So. Yeah. Different from the music.
Yeah. Yeah.
You got some in your nose.
Andy Patterson, he produces albums locally. He is also producer and drummer, currently playing for Hudson River School. Andy, thanks very much for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And Brad Collins, the owner of Raunch Records, former owner of Raunch Records, the former Raunch Records.
Hey, can I make a plug?
Sure, of course.
They can Google me. They can Google us at Raunch Records. It's a one word. And if they need to email me, they can do it through the Google, and I'll just answer their
questions. Perfect. We'll put a link on there, by the way.
Okay, great.
Great, okay. And also, of course, he was the host of the immensely popular Underground Music program on KRCL, Behind the Zion Curtain. Brad, thanks very much.
Thanks, Doug.
For doing this. Gentry Densley, the guitarist for Iceburn, currently plays for Smashy Smashy in form of Rocket. Gentry, thank you.
Thanks.
Very much. And Stormy Shepherd, head of the Salt Lake-based Leave Home Booking. Stormy, thank you very much.
Thanks.
And Duncan Mint, we should mention our friend, local journalist. Thank you very much. Radio West is a production of KUER News. The program is directed by Mike Anderson, produced by Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.